we'll need it.
Bring it in. Okay. So I thought I'd lead us into our explorations of this afternoon by again returning to Teilhard de Chardin and his essay, The Christic, which is a particularly interesting and poignant essay because it was completed less than 2 weeks before he died. Completed in March of 1955, late March of 55, and on Easter Sunday in that same year, April 10th, he died, as was his wish. But as this beautiful piece called The Christic is his final piece, and it's in a sense his last will and testament, summing up all he has seen and felt and heard of the risen Christ in evolution. And he despairs as he comes down the home stretch in this article. And he has right to despair because he's living out what will all too soon prove to be the final days of his life, living in a sort of incomprehensible loneliness and exile in New York City. He goes to his little office at the what was then the Viking and is now the Werner Dren Foundation to do his scientific work. But he's surrounded. His ideas have been viciously throttled by the Vatican. His last attempt to get the phenomena out of man was published, was shot down. So alone, isolated, knowing that he'll never see his beloved France again, and that his whole life is consumed in a body of work which is essentially inaccessible. He writes toward the end of this essay, "How is it then that as I look around me, still dazzled by what I have seen, the beauty of this vision, I find I am almost the only person of my kind, the only one to have seen. And so I cannot, when asked, quote, a single writer, a single work, that gives a clearly expressed expression of this wonderful diaphony that has transfigured everything for me. Is there, in fact, a universal Christ? Is there a divine milieu? Or am I, after all, simply the dupe of a mirage in my own mind? I often ask myself that question." A poignant question to ask. What does it mean that you're the only one that you've seen this? And he stumbles through a few more pages, coming to terms with the fact where he gets a grip and says he's standing by what he sees for whatever, right? And then he says, in the next to the last paragraph, "Everywhere on earth at this moment, in the new spiritual atmosphere created by the appearance of the idea of evolution, there float in a state of extreme mutual sensitivity, love of God and faith in the world, the two essential components of the ultra-human. These two components are everywhere in the air." Interesting. "Generally, however, they are not strong enough, both at the same time, to combine with one another in one and the same subject. In me, it happens by pure chance, temperament, upbringing, background, that the proportion of the one to the other is correct, and the fusion of the two has been effected spontaneously, not as yet with sufficient force to spread explosively, but strong enough nevertheless to make it clear that the process is possible, and that sooner or later there will be a chain reaction. This is one more proof that truth has to appear only once in one single mind for it to be impossible for anything ever to prevent it from spreading universally and setting everything ablaze. His last written piece. And in the process of that way, which he first saw as a principle in evolution, when he was looking at a new biological mutation, he would see it only has to appear once somewhere, and almost instantly by non-localized action, it's in the gene pool, it's in the air, as it were, and it begins to reproduce itself and manifest itself in ways that are not mechanical. They don't require cell-to-cell transmission. It just, boom, it appears everywhere. And he says that's the property of truth, that when it rises, even though at first it's one person in some miserably remote place, it spreads. And in so doing, he not only has named the truth, but once again has described imaginal causality. And described the fact that in our world, according to the laws of World 48, we think you get a great idea, the next thing you have to do is get a publicist, get the idea out there, go big, you know, make sure the network is there, follow up with opinion polls, you know. This is why my poor email box has to be cleared every few weeks, because the junks, the polls, you know. But it appears by non-localized action, as it appears in this world. It's just there, and then it's everywhere. And so I think this is a profound sense, source of hope. As we start to look in this last session, I want to share some thoughts about the conscious circle of humanity and why it is that even in small, out-of-the-way little groups such as these that look like they have an absolute insignificant weight even in their local environment. I don't think there's more than a couple of shopkeepers that have a clue what we're doing up here. That yet there's a force and a sort of inertia, a momentum that moves through imaginal gathering to imaginal gathering, that is part of the viaduct for the apparently instantaneous communication of a new awareness in people. So that while it looks hopeless from a linear standpoint, it's already happening by the time you wake up and find your way to Stonington. It's that kind of a, you know, we all love to say that, you know, that when you look at these four prophets, none of them started with a movement. It instantly generated around the explosive force that was conveyed in the truth of what they were saying. So there's an old Hasidic saying that the world at any point is held in its orbit by 36 conscious human beings. In the Hasidic tradition, of course, 36 conscious men. And they don't know each other. And they don't even know if they're one of the 36. But the quality of their work is such that it not only makes a qualitative impact itself, but rises like incense, instantaneously in the atmosphere to find its way to the work of the other 35 and create a band around the planet which literally prevents it from cavitating, either morally or spiritual or physically. You know, that there's energetic perfection, protection. And I think that if you've been paying attention at all this week, you see that when you start working with vibration, that morality and physical platforms and physical work are not that far apart. They're all variations on a gamut of vibration, and anything can be impacted by anything else. Another great secret of the work between the worlds. So when my teacher Rafe saw that, he was all over that. God, was he excited. All he knew is he wanted to be one of those 36. And, you know, Rafe was quite the character, because he was the hermit monk of Snowmass, and he'd found his way after a lot of drifting. He started out as a lay brother at Conyers, and finally found his way by long series to the monastery at Snowmass, where they gave him a little hermitage a mile or so above the monastery, and he served the monastery by being their plumber and electrician. And other than that, he got to sit up in his high lonesome and be a hermit. So he read Gurdjieff on the side, that one of Thomas Keating's attendants in the early days of contemplative outreach was a member of the Bennett Gurdjieff group in Santa Fe. And so she used to feed him information. She got him Nichols' commentaries. She got him Bennett's book called Sex, which he really liked, and a few dozen other things. So he would sit up at the work and read, or at the cabin, read his Lectio Divina every day. You know, his particular way through Lectio Divina was to read the Bible cover to cover. And when he finished once, he started again. And in the course of his monastic life, he was on his fifth trip through when death claimed him. And he also read Nichols' commentaries, and he'd been through them a few times. I think he read them further each day than he read the Bible, because he was so overwhelmed by the Bible that he could only read two sentences and then he'd be stopped. And he'd ponder that for, you know, 3 or 4 days or a month. And when he had ingested that, he went on to the next. So the Bible went slow for him. But when he somehow bumped into the idea of the conscious circle, whether it was in Nichol or whether it was in Search of the Miraculous, hotshot, that's it. And the way he made sense of me, when I showed up on his plate at the end of his life, very much diverting what he thought was his monastic career trajectory, he made sense of it by saying that he understood that I was the last task given to him to create a conscious bridge between the worlds. And he knew very well from the moment that I showed up on his path that the countdown to his death was on. And he made he didn't equivocate about that, but nor did he back off a bit. That he understood that when he had imparted to me the very least I needed to know to be able to hang on from my end, that he was good to go. So that's how it went. And for various reasons I came to discover along the way, very quickly after he departed the physical flesh, that he was right. That while all of my wise World 48 friends were counseling me to, it's time for closure, and if you hang on, you're holding him back, you know, all these things they always say to you. But it was like, hey, look, I'm hands-free, but he's got me by the back of my neck, you know. that there was a ferocity in the bond and a flow in the bond. And I got to discover feet first that the way he construed the conscious circle of humanity actually was empirically true to me. That it consists of a group of people on either side of the life-death divide, which means basically some physically in World 48 and some beyond it. Principally, particularly at the start, in World 24. So So you've got individuated persons on both sides of the life-death barrier. And they form a bridge across. And across that bridge flows, as we're going to see, cosmic assistance. And the conscious circle of humanity is a kind of subset of the general, what I've talked about the imaginal realm and the way it works in this, in vis-a-vis this realm, is that its specific mission is the guidance, protection, shepherding, and nurturing of this, of me, Vixtus Orbis, in a very, very particular and tender way, fierce but tender. And there are more than 36 of them. So you don't have to try and make the beauty contest. but nonetheless, it's a bandwidth that allows information, guidance, wisdom to be conveyed across the realms. The basic vehicle used for it is your Kesdjan body, your second body. And if you're beginning to develop that body in the planetary being, blessed are you for many reasons, because it makes it particularly easy and fruitful. Some of these guys are, you know, kind of big-time saints. I mean, that there are many people on the other side. The ones we name as saints, I think, are specifically ones that have elected with their hearts to be part of the conscious circle of humanity. And people pray to them, the St. Francis's, the St. Anthony's, the ones whose hearts are so tenderly turned toward the planet that the faithful still feel personally connected to them. St. Joseph, you name them, they really exist. Mary Magdalene is there, and she and Jesus have existed in a particularly intense configuration, and even more intense during the time she was still physically in the body and he was beyond. So that basically is the setup, that there is such a thing as a deep band of guidance and assistance that's available to us right on the other side in imaginal causality, that you don't have to petition excessively, because there's a willingness to be there. And it comes with the implicit, and not only implicit, but explicit affirmation that this planet is both difficult and precious, and about in equal measure. You know, it's confused, muddled, mixed up, incredibly fragile, and yet so beautiful and so particular and so crucial to the scheme of things, that it is protected fiercely. And if we knew how fiercely it was protected, we wouldn't be quite so lost and forlorn and narcissistic, because we're carefully watched here in this world. And when it says in John 3 that God so loved the world that he gave his only beloved son, if you don't get distracted by exclusivity in that and just stay with the love, you hear it saying, this place, this realm with its particularly infuriating density, something really important goes on. And as a conscious human being, or at least an aspirant to being a conscious human being, you have a role to play with that. And there is dignity that accrues to you by the very fact of your having been born in this flesh. A dignity we all too often forget. Mm. But, so help is available. Yeah, Don.
This is going to seem like a foolish question, but for our sakes, and for the sake of those to whom, when we go home, we try to explain, I don't know how many of you are going to try to explain what happened at this conference, but I can just hear a friend of mine saying, oh, yeah, communication between the worlds, oh, yeah. Well, my auntie used to go to a medium, and they had seances, and boy, they were really tuned in. I didn't believe it, but they really were. They were talking to Uncle Elmer and Grandpa and blah, 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 blah. And Cynthia's response is...
That's the sentimental and superstitious bottom end of something that truly exists, you know. Seances, and of course necromancy, and it's amazing how our church got down on necromancy, the idea of disturbing the dead, without understanding that the aliveness of the man and the saints. I would respond, Don, by simply directing them away from seances and spiritualism toward prayer to the saints, assistance from above, the devotion over the ages to people and to folks whose impact is collective on the whole planet. It's not a private kind of visit into the nether realms, but is a God-given channel. And I'd start with that. You know, there's always a sort of superstitious and personalized sentimental bottom end to everything. A Valentine's Day card with a Cupid plucking up, you know, a heart that you give to your boyfriend or girlfriend is the bottom end of a long chain that speaks so virally of angelic assistance. So just don't let it be reduced to a simple version of itself and then thrown out. So,
Cynthia, can I also ask a quick question?
Yeah.
So you've given us this example, very personal example in your own life about you and Ray, and that has to do with quite a passionate love. I was wondering if you could give some examples of other ways that these bonds are forged or...
Yeah. Oh, sure. You know, I mean, I've got Thomas Keating on my back big time. And there wasn't any passionate love there. Conflictual father-daughter relationships for 30 years. But there's absolutely no doubt, you know, that in the events that unfolded in the last 5 years of my life, that he's not done with me. Mm-hmm. Nor is he done with the planet. And I've been absolutely stunned. One of the things I've been doing during this week is I'm keeping an eye on the course on Thomas Keating's Sacred Embrace Poems that's going on this week. And we're right now at the most difficult poem where Thomas is totally disillusioned and saying, the God I thought I knew no longer exists. And I thought, God, this is going to play well with the contemplative outreach groupies. They're taking it. And what's going on in the dialogue this week in the practice forum has just become miraculous. Wow. Because the wiser ones among them are leading. Wow. The ones that are quiet without being pushy or teachy. Yes. But they're bringing there's a whole light of understanding that's growing up within this that a couple of people have commented about. And they say, huh, that's interesting. You know? And for me, that's almost a cleaner example of it. That as you develop your own Kesjan body, and I think we can use that language comfortably maybe in this group now, that inner body within, that will come naturally as you do the spiritual work. As you develop that, and as your imagination permits it, you will naturally become more aware of the people, the people that are meeting us from the conscious circle on the other side, have maintained their individuality, maintained their personhood so as to be recognizable. You know, you would never mix, you would never confuse Mary Magdalene and Mother Mary. You just wouldn't do it. Completely different, as different as, you know, me and Heather. You pick it right up. So you know them by their scent. They still have it. But they are recognized not by their outer form, but by the inner quality of their aliveness. And so if you allow yourself to represent to yourself that this source of aid and guidance exists, don't be surprised at what follows. But this is the reason why the imaginal realm has so often, in descriptions, particularly Jungian descriptions and Asian descriptions, been described as the subtle realm. And it's been traditionally equated with the realm of prophecies, inner guidance, outer guidance, inner knowing, the messages from your archetypal self, as Jung got a hold of it. Because there's the visceral experience is that as you begin to enter this realm, you find you know more than you know, and you know it in a different way that we like to call intuition, which isn't quite the right word, but probably will do for now. That we know it not because we've deduced it or figured it out or concluded it, but because it's a fundamental knowingness in us that can't be unknown. You can't know a moment before you knew it, even though you can chronologically say, oh yeah, there was a time I didn't know that. But once it enters, it enters with such authority that you do speak with authority and not like the scribes and Pharisees. So it's that realm, and it's been well attested that we receive guidance. But the way the message has tended to be received by us is again for everything on that personal level. You get it so it can help you live your little life better. And what the conscious circle really adds heft to is by saying that it is by nature collective and prophetic. It really is only incidentally interested in you and whether you marry this guy or that guy or live in Stonington or live in Florida. What it's interested in is the preservation of the conditions in which life becomes possible, moral life of conscience becomes possible on this planet, and we are protected. So while the conscious circle tends to remain underground for very good reasons, with which I would say, please, Don, don't try to tell people what went on this week, except that you played your trumpet and met some fishermen, that it tends to come above ground in more visible ways at certain times in the course of planetary history. And these are either times of grave ecological or planetary, political, ecological crisis, or at times when there's about to be a quantum change in human consciousness, in a level of human consciousness. And then you tend to find wisdom schools springing up, where these kinds of knowledges emerge briefly above ground to become sort of centers and fountainheads of teaching and instruction. And the one thing, yeah, Don?
If you hadn't brought up prophecy, which you said three times or so,
yeah,
I'm thinking Laura would connect with me, I think, on this, although straight me down, because she cut her teeth in a charismatic community. Forget it. Anyway,
who did?
Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I have maybe 100 pastor friends who are part of the charismatic community.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet once a month.
Mm-hmm.
John says, what are you meeting with them for? But there's usually prayer and laying out of hands and healing and speaking in tongues. And occasionally afterwards, we have some guys that are experienced in dream interpretation. You didn't mention dreams, but I assume that falls into that rubric.
Mm-hmm.
So over here, we have this wisdom group community, and they're not popping, but moving gently into World 24 and then back to 48. And then over here, we have a totally different group,
mm-hmm.
not so gentle, but they're popping up all the time, and they think they live in World 24.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, there's some, I'm not passing judgment on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that we got these two different groups that are so different. My guess is that very few of them would feel comfortable here, and very few of us would feel comfortable there. And yet they both seem to be tapping into this imaginal.
Yep.
So in other words, simply because we're operating in room in World 24 doesn't mean we get along. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we got to get to World 12 or 3 or something like that.
You know, Don, without getting too sidetracked, I would hold it out as a very real possibility that we could get along. Because I think what binds together the charismatic movement and traditional the traditional self-understanding of wisdom is far closer together than what separates them. And I think it puts them far closer to each other than it does to rationalistic Christianity. Because what the group both have in common is the understanding of the reality of what you might call, for lack of a better term, the subtle world. And its immediate and heartful bearings on this world. And that's a powerful ground. And I think it's a communications problem rather than in any sort of ontological difference between the groups, that as we become more respectful of what's going on. They're working at, I hope it doesn't sound snarky to say that they're working at different levels. That what happens, What always the danger is when you start working with a subtle level is that you can go woohoo real fast. That you need a good, strong grounding in the rational. And if it gets taken home to a possessive ego and any sort of undealt with psychological wounds and blind spots, it can tend to get skewed accordingly, which is why you can occasionally get charismatic leaders that run seriously amok, as well as imaginal leaders that run seriously amok. But what Gurdjieff was really interested in was that he thought that if you could get people really grounded in sensation and aware of all the kind of ploys of their self, that they would learn how to listen with a greater degree of subtlety and objectivity, so it wouldn't so run off the rails into hysteria or zealotry or superstition or so many things which are shadow side when a very subtle transmission gets interpreted too coarsely. So a lot of the work in the classic inner work schools has to do with purifying the level of being so that you don't have so much distortion from your lower self. But they're
didn't
all
you,
on a continuum.
Didn't you mention Francis McNutt just briefly in that book?
I don't know if I did, but
Did you have interfacing with him?
Not significant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But there is a gamut. And one of the interesting things that I wouldn't disregard as Third Force stumbles into the planet, would be a hookup, a new alliance between the esoteric tradition, the wisdom school, and the heart-centered charismatic traditions. Not the mean evangelical rejecting cold, you know, but the ones that are open to the heart of Christ. I think there's likely to be a possibility of a resurgence there. So stay with your groups and think it's just changing costume, not changing nature. Yeah, Eileen?
That's what I meant. I'm sorry.
But I, you know, I have seen, for the last year, we've been having a little wisdom school at our house, and I've invited some of the teachers. Some of them I've known for 40 years. Deeply charismatic, deeply committed to Christ, and the transformation in this year, and what they, when we get together and they say, I could never have gone through this without what we learned in wisdom school. I mean, it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. So it does, I think, I want to agree,
yeah.
There is a way that it comes together. And I've seen plenty of charismatics just be doing it in their own egoicness.
Yeah,
you know.
There is a bridge there. I'm absolutely convinced
there's
a bridge. The charismatics tend to get scared off by language that's wrong, that sounds new agey. But if you can get through the language barrier, there's a path that can be trod together.
When we did Wisdom Way of Knowing together, there were a lot of those language barriers.
Yeah.
And I just said, just take a breath.
Yeah.
Let it go. If it doesn't speak to you, just deal with what speaks to you.
Yeah.
We've gone through both Wisdom Way of Knowing and Mystical Hope with this group.
Yeah.
And both of us were concerned that this wouldn't sit well and that the bridge couldn't happen, but it happened almost immediately. And it is deep.
Mm-hmm. Interesting possibility here. You know, I've heard other such stories, and that does my heart good.
Yeah, me too.
Anyway, one of the things I wanted to do back to the main plot is to just sort of comment that when you read the Old Testament from this point of view, you discover pretty fast that the history of Israel and their unfolding is really sort of bookended between their encounters with two of the most powerful wisdom schools recorded in the planet. The first being the one in Egypt, and the second being the one in Babylon. And so, by various reasons of Semitic skullduggery, Joseph winds up being sold and for slavery and taken to Egypt, where he finds himself under the tutelage of one of the most profound wisdom schools that's ever hit the planet. Still remarkable. And came back, and it was in that mix. It was in Egypt, which by then, as you read the story in the Bible, is looked upon as horrible slavery. But the idea of the personal covenantal God that was delivered to Moses many, many generations after Joseph's misfortune grew up at the junction point between Egyptian wisdom and Semitic intuitive genius. And I think that the tendency of that when you read the Bible is to read it as a one-off and think that you got these miraculous little people out of contact with anybody, and the ones that can't convert they kill, but it was, you know. But it was within the womb of the wisdom school at Egypt that a new revelation was going that changed the history of the planet. Classic. And then when the poor rowdy bunch got picked up and dragged to Babylon, kicking and screaming, there they got exposed to a couple of profound new ideas that were not in the canon before. They joined up with the percolating wave of the idea that we have an individual soul, that we have an individual destiny, heaven and hell, angelology entered there. And they came back, most interestingly, with the rising glimmers of what you could call bodhisattva consciousness as it begins to rise in that strange figure of the Son of Man, the mysterious suffering servant who takes upon him the sins of the world. This is all post-exilic stuff. So again, it's Israel who seems to be the, as one of my Jewish tour guides readers says, Israel is the pencil bowl, the pencil that God writes with. And this may be so, but the language being written is evolving wisdom. And it's one of the reasons I love the Bible, and I love that the Old Testament, and I'm really glad they didn't decide to junk it, because it's a history of the intersection of wisdom with a historical person tracing the West. When you read it from that point of view, it's just stunning. So wisdom schools rise in those occasions. There have been other great schools, the proverbial school of Atlantis, smaller schools certainly in Tibet. Some say that the Druidic strain, as it swept across Paris, carried wisdom. It never formed really with that kind of masterful heft. But there have been these expressions that have percolated up through the era. And our own age is absolutely consistent. You know, if we're facing at this point both a profound global planetary crisis, and I think our ecological crisis certainly counts as that nowadays. It's escalated to the fact that climate change is not going to leave the lay of the land significantly rearranged. And along with this kind of crazy breakdown or breakthrough moment, where on the one hand we seem to be moving in more intensity than we've ever moved towards a kind of collective non-dual, more and more people are able to hold the collective vision of humanity. And yet at the same time you see this massive reactivity and fear that comes up almost as a shadow. So it's a volatile time, and it's not surprising that the wisdom stream spontaneously emerges above ground again. And this little way station is certainly not unique, as Fayard was saying. You know, everywhere, in different formats and different guises, a new kind of scent is in the air, and they do connect. But I wanted to just review from the book the three ways in which the conscious circle has traditionally offered assistance during these times, whether it's really firmly formed as a wisdom school or a line or something, or whether it's more loosely out there filtering in the mix up. Three functions that have been classic, the first of which is I call cosmic dialysis. We talked about this a lot yesterday, which is the conscious purification of the toxicity of the environment, both the physical environment and the moral environment, the spiritual psychic environment, caused principally by human sin, human anguish, human misbehavior, human greed, the toxicity, and as well the pain, the fear, the suffering, you know, whether justly or unjustly deserved, that's part of the pain body of humanity. That a lot of the work of a conscious circle is always the intentional suffering of stepping into that, and is in some sense trying to cleanse the atmosphere so that life becomes breathable and bearable again. And I think I'm I think that's clearly on our plate. We talked about that yesterday as almost one of the most important functions staff, both in World 48 and in World 24. We're suffering from a toxified environment, toxified by at least 50 years of greed, consumerism, fear, narcissism, rising out of a fundamental sense of meaninglessness and disconnection. You know, I have pity for it. It's not that we humans are arrogant, swaggering sinners. It was the heartbreak of discovering ourselves meaningless orphans in a pitiless cosmos that fueled this quest for security, for satisfaction here, for narcissism, for protection. It's the breakdown of our sense of connectedness, not only horizontally but vertically, which I think really is driving human misbehavior and not the other way around. So and as we've seen, a lot of that has to be dealt with just energetically. You have to bite into the fear. You have to bite into the terror. You have to take a piece of it and offer your own being as the cleansing place for it. So we talked about that yesterday, the tonglen of our time, the conscious breathing, not only to receive the substances, but to participate in the cleansing and assimilation of an air that's become too scary to people. And, you know, my stories, you know, Eileen's story that she told me at lunchtime still haunts me, of her great nephew's first and second day at school. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell the story briefly of what that telephone call was all about?
Yeah, so I got a text just as we were starting after our break this morning, and my sister said, "Can you please call us because Oliver's having a really hard time at school?" And apparently yesterday was his first day, and the industrial sound of the toilet just freaked him out.
He's kindergarten, right?
He's kindergarten. And so he's a really articulate, sensitive kind of kid. And what happened was my niece called up the school or emailed or texted and said, "Tomorrow, would you just remind him to use the restroom because he had peed in his pants and he was very upset about that yesterday." And so Melinda said, "He's afraid of the sound of the toilet." So when he arrived today, the teacher took him, and I can imagine, you know, here she is masked. You know, kids are scared. There's no warm smile, you know. And she was probably doing the best that she could possibly do in these circumstances. And she took him in the bathroom and said, "This is where the bathroom is, and here's the sound of the toilet." And he just freaked out and threw up. At which point they rushed him down to the nurse, because any kid that throws up has to go home and get a COVID test. So, and Melinda couldn't go into the school. She wasn't allowed to go into the school. So he's in the nurse's office. She said it must have been the first kid they sent home because they didn't have a protocol. They didn't know what they were doing. And she wasn't upset with the school. She was more upset, how does she help him work through this? So any of you that feel led to pray for Oliver. Anyway, on the way to the test, to get the COVID test, he's like, "Am I going to get COVID?" Aww. And I just, this escalation, so by the time, what ended up happening, he did get the COVID test, and the woman was wonderful. She said, "I'm just going to tickle your nose a little." And he even laughed, and I was so grateful for that. So, I just prayed with Melinda, and I just said, you need to get into a place of peace and bring him into that. Mm-hmm. But it's really normal for kindergarten kids to be scared. But what we have is a sensitive kid in the time of COVID. He's reacting to everything else. How stressed those teachers must be.
I'm so there. I mean, my 10-year-old is having daily anxiety attacks, and he made it through on Tuesday, the day without having one, but yesterday he had one. And it's this sensitive kids in general, going through natural physical changes, emotional changes. He's in a new school, and the normal difficulties are exacerbated times a million by this. They can't see each other's faces. The oppressive nature of something pushing up against your nose and your mouth all day. I mean, and just when I was tempted to think it was just me or just us, I posted about it, and I had moms emailing me asking, so how are you working through it? How can you help? Can you help me? Can you help us? Mm-hmm. So there's a real need for this kind of practical peace guidance so that our children can have that atmosphere around them.
Well, you know, my niece doesn't have much of a relationship. I know she has a relationship with God, but it's not outward at all. She's not a churchgoer. She's not... Because I said, have you ever talked to Oliver about God or peace or anything? And she said, no. And I said, well, maybe you should ask your mother to have a chat with him, and my sister is going to do that. But I told Melinda, I'd call her on Sunday when we could, you know, when we had time and we could just talk. But this is magnified. And kids who are sensitive are picking that up. I said, is like being a barometer right now. Don't take this personally. He might have been scared of kindergarten without this, but he's a barometer.
I'm seeing it. And the thing about kids is that they can read the energy fields. They haven't learned how to calibrate them. And, you know, and no matter how much the adults like to say, well, we're just being compassionate, we're being courteous, kids pick up fear when it's there.
Yeah.
You know, they aren't kidding, and they're taking the brunt in an awful way of the residual fear that the adults mask with control, and the kids are just feeling helpless and traumatized. And if nothing else, Tung Glen in this direction to take on the atmosphere of terror and you know, send an intention for these poor little kids that are caught in a, you know, in a dystopic world not of their own making.
Yeah.
So anyway, Tung Glen, dialysis, do it. Do it for your own sake, do it for your planet's sake, do it for the whatever part of the pain body you want to tackle. That's part of the work. Second part has traditionally been guidance. And when we sit here feeling that I've been led. I suddenly have this image, I have this vision, it popped into me. Where did it come from? And part of the traditional work one-on-one in wisdom has been to transmit guidance and to receive guidance. And the classic model we have in our biblical tradition is that when somebody wants to receive guidance, they go out into a desert and they go through a period of mortification, 40 days being the typical, of extreme fasting and asceticism to bring their mind, body, being into attunement, and then they receive a revelation. And this is, of course, classically played out in the Old Testament prophets, but as well and classically as Jesus in the temptations in the wilderness. So that's our prevailing model of we receive guidance individually after a period of ascetic. But both Gurdjieff and Teilhard were evolutionary in sensing and insisting that guidance can actually be transmitted at a higher level in a group. You know? And that's not any old group. You know, that's not, you know, a fellowship that gets together to study this, that, or the other, still operating by the old rules. But if you've heard a kind of emphasis through this whole structure, about forming a web. We worked on that really hard the first few days, about practicing, about bringing our listening into sync. It sometimes becomes possible, it frequently becomes possible, to receive and understand things in small bands that can't be received and understood in a larger group. We had a really wonderful picture of that in Valley Crucis with the tapestry that we wove out of the polypropylene rope. It's still out on my deck if you want to look at it. But everybody wove their own little things, and they were beautiful. And we were hanging them up like show and tell, and they said, well, what happens if we put it out a few days earlier and they start dialoguing? And so we began to get a cross-weaving as people interacted with each other's creativity. Became infinitely more beautiful. So, and Teilhard says there's a good reason for that, because as you converge closer to the evolutionary omega point, you can expect more complex structures to bear more complex levels of consciousness. So, and finally, schools contribute, or can, or conscious circle action often contributes third force. And remember, we've talked about third force in many, many ways this over the 2 years or so we've been working with the Law of Three, but that sometimes things seem to be locked in impasse and nothing will give, and the situation seems hopeless and frozen, and then something emerges out of left field that all of a sudden shakes up a configuration, and there's a different outcome. Some people would say, my teacher Murat Yagan used to insist that this was the principal business of the conscious circle, to be amenable to transmit third force in the world. But there are a couple of stories, and I'll end my own kind of presentation on that with this, that one such example, I think, is with when the Chinese communists rolled into Tibet in 1959 and smashed apart the holy city and the enclosed nature of Tibetan Buddhism. It was, of course, a catastrophe. And the bloodshed and the massacre of monks was horrendous, and the wounds remain clear till this day. But it threw the teaching into diaspora. And out of that dislocation, it took less than a decade before we had profound Buddhist teachers showing up in North America and everywhere, the Rinpoches, who came and brought Tibetan Buddhism to the world, where it's become a powerful force. And at the same time, the Dalai Lama has emerged as a cosmic spokesperson. And so, in a sense, what looked like it was a catastrophe in the short haul was really a rearrangement which led to the insemination of a whole new spiritual infusion into the world, a whole new energy and wisdom. And sometimes things happen that way. And sometimes you just got to be around. And while you're putting all your effort into your plan and your mission statement, and you think it's going to go this way, and you keep going this way, and then off in your peripheral vision, something opens over here that may not even be directly connected to it, but somehow the atmosphere has been affected in some sort of way that something has jumped across. And my very favorite story for all of that is the story of Gurdjieff in Paris, in behind enemy lines, in, you know, most of the spiritual teachers fled from the occupied lands. Paris became occupied in 1941. Gurdjieff happened to be there. He didn't leave. He didn't go off to some tranquil country place where you could do your spiritual work uninterrupted. He stayed in his little apartment up behind the, just down the hill from the Arc de Triomphe, and about a half a mile as the crow flies from Nazi headquarters at the Place de Concorde. He stayed right there, and he started feeding people. And, of course, he used to be a black market guy and a hypnotist guy. He said, he always said, you ought to be able to make money with your left toe. And God knows what deals he was trading, but he had a back pantry with an outdoor step to it, which was always unlocked, and anybody could come at any time to get staples, you know, flour, all the stuff. And then he had this inside pantry where he had all these delicacies for Don chocolate, for Andrew cigarettes, for Joan Armagnac. And he used to put together these over-the-top banquets that would go on for hours, where he would cook these Middle Eastern dinners and entertain people with stories and teachings. So essentially, both physically and spiritually, he was feeding a group of people in the midst of this. The coldest winter on record was the winter of 1942, worldwide. Cold, bleak, and there he was. So, and people began to notice that there was a different edge to his teaching, that there was less and less method, but there was a direct touch of love. And it was in one of those meetings around that time that he gave that line about the web. He gave the original teaching of the web atmosphere, web exercise, and says, we form a web, it could warm Paris. Well, 1944, things are going the other way for the Nazis. That June 6th, they land, the Allied forces land on the beach in Normandy and begin striking their way relentlessly toward Paris. Not without fierce battles, as you all know, but they are making their way. And by August 23 or 24, they're at the gates of Paris. They're at the Porte d'Orléans, the Porte d'Italie down there in the southern quarter, and the German army of the occupation is preparing to evacuate. And of course, it's a widely known secret that Hitler was not going to allow this just to happen as a retreat. They had placed bombs underneath the great artifacts of Paris, Notre Dame, the Louvre, and upon their departure, the orders were to blow up these sacred monuments of human culture, leave them so that nothing was left. And negotiations were going on fast and furious. Hitler was pretty sure that he had the right guy in the place to do it, that the commander of the French army of the occupation there was a fellow by the name of Dietrich Klotilz, who was picked because of his superior record for butchery logged in Croatia. And so there was no doubt that he would, you know, he'd do the job that needed to be done. So fierce negotiations back and forth. There were some Norwegians involved. There's a whole story about it. They can't get anywhere. You know, the Allied forces are now at the southern door of Paris and making their way. And on August 25th, they roll right down the Seine, right down the boulevard on the north side of the Seine. The Germans go, no building is blown up. The order is never given. Nobody to this day knows why. And you can't make a causal link, but in my heart of hearts, I'm absolutely sure that that work that went on a half a mile away with the feeding, with the warming, with the caring, with the infusions of pure love which Gurdjieff was consciously transmitting into the planet at that point, had some effect that he did in some mysterious way warm the atmosphere of Paris. And I hold that up as a case story. I can't prove it, but when I put my imaginal eye on, it can't not have happened. The events were too close together, and he was a little bit too good about how he knew how to interpenetrate physical energies with. And I would simply put that before you again for your imagination. That as we hold fast to all that is real, that is all that is true, all that is beautiful, all that is loving. I can't do the quote exactly. You could probably do that one, Don. Whatever those are, think ye of those things. You know, as we hold fast to that highest image of what it means to be a human being, and we don't allow that image to be tarnished, no matter the fear, no matter the hatred, something remains in the atmosphere at the high water mark of what we can maintain. And that something is not without influence. And whether it operates suddenly as a kind of conducive atmosphere in which things can all of a sudden come together in a different way when it looked hopeless, maybe. Or if things all go to hell in a handbasket and the human race is extinct or semi-extinct for 500 years, it'll be back. Because we've held the note as well as we can. And it won't be lost. So I think the work of the conscious circle at this point is to hold that note. To hold that note of what a human being is in love, in tenderness, in compassion, gentleness, forbearance. Live it, and where it gets crosswise with personal fear, push the envelope a little and see if you can still live it. See how far you can walk it. Walk it with your friends. And every triumph over terror and self-preservation in any human soul is a qualitative and permanent triumph for the world. So that's about all I wanted to teach. Comments, reflections, questions?
If anything, I feel so grateful for this time, but moved to encourage us to think really creatively and practically about these groups that we're holding and that we may feel invited to hold. I think bringing up this example of children is a case in point of the unbelievable overwhelm that parents are facing right now, the ways in which we could be agents of an inner Peace Corps to really facilitate and translate what we've learned and what we're learning in a deeply practical, accessible, I'm deeply moved by this image of Gurdjieff feeding.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such nurturing food. I want to encourage us to really workshop creatively how we can feed our communities.
Yeah. 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 And sometimes you just do it. Just you see what's needed. You see the need and you fill it best you can.
Yeah.
And then things grow out of that. But yeah.
Cynthia?
Yeah.
The other thing is that I my training was in medical technology, so I spent time in microbiology, virology, serology, a lot of ologies. But it bothers me sometimes when people call COVID the enemy or
mm-hmm.
how evil it is, we have to eradicate it. It's just a virus.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing what it needs to do. It's doing what it does.
Yeah.
And as has been said before, what is really the virus? It's really us. And, you know, can we make friends with the invitation of the virus?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe open to a different viewpoint to this season. It is inviting us into something very important.
Mm-hmm.
I think even the way we speak about the virus or what it's asking of us or what it's inviting us into makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. And there has been benefit. It's terrible suffering for many.
Mm-hmm.
It is asking a lot of questions of us. But the virus is neutral. It's doing what it does, and there are many times viruses have protected us.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to give a word in for nature itself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've had a proliferation of signs in town today. Some of you may have noticed, and they got a new one down at the Fish Fair that says, you know, it's all masks and things that says, "Crush the virus." You know, it's like, you know, this whole thing again, that somehow wearing a mask is going to kill the virus. But it's that same inimical attitude that everybody's developing. Not everybody is going to do everything, you know, and we're not advocating any form of evangelizing that changes anybody's opinions. And just moving through the raindrops in a slightly different way. Yeah, Bob.
Yeah, I'm wondering if we can add one more practice to the three you gave us.
Mm-hmm.
So over the last 6-7 months, I listened to Beelzebub's Tales and finally completed it. And toward the end, Beelzebub's grandson ask him if there's any hope for the human race, any possible way to direct them into the path of becoming. And so it's just these two paragraphs struck me. So Beelzebub rises and he stretches his right hand forward and his left hand backwards. He directs his vision to a far-off horizon, piercing the very depths of space, and with a loud voice he intones these words, "Thou all and the allness of my wholeness, the sole means now for the saving of the beings of the planet Earth, would be to implant again into their presences a new organ of such properties that every one of them should constantly sense the inevitability of their own death, as well as the death of everyone upon whom their eyes rest. So I did take on at the beginning of the year. My intent was to live it as if this was my last year,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like it's not going to be my last year. But that whole discipline of working with my own mortality,
mm-hmm.
and viscerally seeing it, it produced so much fruit.
Yeah.
And then to see that everyone I looked at upon in my own family and as I walked down the street,
mm-hmm.
The same thing. It's like this, there's something that gets galvanized,
mm-hmm.
in that constant awareness.
Yeah. Yes. Amen.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the theme that reverberates from the Desert Fathers and Mothers. Sit in your cell and ponder the hour of your death. Not for morbidity, but just so that you don't pussyfoot around.
Mm-hmm.
And for the freedom that living with death behind you. And in a funny way, you've taken on exactly the thing that everybody else is so scared of. Because you look at that, and people are saying that all the time, oh my God, I'm going to die, and everybody else is going to die too. And to take it on consciously and calmly as, yes, this is a fact of life. This is so. Now get on with it. Yes, Steve.
I just would add to that. It's like this morning you described what's missing is courage. It came to me, I think, when Tim was reading, it's that... face this kind of this sense of death is not what it's like, what you previously thought it was.
Yeah.
It comes across as like to me, Tim's reading a love letter,
yeah.
not a letter about courage.
Yeah.
And so, what occurs to me is while yes, courage might be missing, to the doer of the thing, they would never describe it as courage.
Yeah.
But to the observer of the doer, they would describe it as courage.
Yes, good. That's a very good correction. And of course, when you come with courage, means the way of the heart. Of course, because the only thing that can overcome your fear of death is your love of life, your of real life.
Yours and
of God's, life of the heart, life of the conscience. And when you do that, it's a no-brainer. I mean, you don't even think about it. You don't say, oh, well, it'd be courageous to go this way. You just instantaneously know this is the only way you can go. That's courage for me. It doesn't count the cost because it sees what it loves. So thank you. That's absolutely right. And to pick up that love letter, which is where that magnetic strength comes in that reading. You know, it's just so filled with this. You know, you guys are going to think I'm a wimp. You guys are going to think I'm crazy. You know, but here is how I call it. I stand in love. In the most courageous place you can stand. So, okay. Wow. I hate to be coming down the home stretch. We have, by common consensus, almost all of a Eucharistic meal if the bread showed up.
Mm-hmm.
The bread showed up.
Yep.
Multi-grain crackers.
Yeah. So, do you need to take like 5 minutes to go pee or something like that, or are you good to go? Or
good to go, but I can speak.
This will be. So